Hey everybody, Greg Bornstein here, consciousness disruptor, curator of experience, and of course, cultural hypnotist. Yes, I am a chief looper, and if you're just joining us, let me loop you in to what's happened so far. This is a special mini-series within the podcast, Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend, called Podcast Pegasus, the U.S. Time Travel Disclosure Series. The primary focus has been Andrew D. Bishago, who is a lawyer professor in Seattle, Washington, who has claims, very credible, I've done a lot of research, very credible claims that he was part of the U.S. teleportation and time travel secret projects in the mid-20th century. Sounds outrageous, right? Well, if you've listened to part one and part two so far, it's hard to dismiss a lot of what he's saying. In the sense that, well, you listen to him and you tell me that he's making it up. Fascinating stuff so far. Definitely check out the first two episodes if you haven't. But in this episode, part three, Through the Looking Glass, I throw Andy a bunch of questions about other time travel conspiracy theories. The Philadelphia Experiment, the Montauk Project, even that classic internet meme, John Titor, the man from the future. We also discuss some other big names in the time travel claims and speculation community, including Elon Musk, Ronald Mallett, and, well, I get to start this episode. This episode starts with me asking Andrew D. Bishago that age-old question, are you out of your mind? Are you crazy? Is that where your head's at? I ask it in a much nicer way, but for those of you listening that are thinking that, don't worry. I check in. Take a listen. It gets interesting. Very much appreciated Andy's honesty, his philosophical perspective on all these matters. Get ready to go through the looking glass. It's an all-new Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Has that happened to you? How many people have said, okay, you are there, there's either something schizophrenic or there's a psychotic break, or in your life, how often have you encountered that, and what, how does that go usually?
Well, basically, now bear in mind, all of the time travel activity and the Mars activity I was involved in was actively hidden from my mother and four older siblings. Now, my mother passed away in 2003. I had been her full-time caregiver from the time she developed cancer in 2007 and had been just staying with her to keep her company for a few years before then, after I got back from Cambridge. So my legal career was kind of stagnating at that point, but I loved my mother as much as life itself, and therefore it was a joy to prevent her from going to a hospice or a convalescent home, especially after she developed cancer. And I was, you know, her full-time caregiver for 6 years.
Yeah.
Now, during those years, that gave me the time to investigate and write down my experiences in Project Pegasus for the most part, because I would remain amnestic about Project Mars until 2009. Okay. And so when my mom was passing away from like 2000 to 2003, my four older siblings quite naturally and understandably, and I certainly forgive them for this, they thought I was just suffering from a delusional disorder based on the stress I had been under taking care of my mom. I mean, we were no longer kids. I mean, I was 42 when my mom passed. And, you know, I had known her for 42 years. It was very difficult.
Yeah.
I miss her. You know, I still love my mom and I miss her. And my dad. But that was the only time when anybody came to me and said, look, you need to get your head examined by a head doctor. And I did. I got examined by a psychiatrist at Kaiser Permanente. And he just sat down with me in his office and he pulled some paper out of his blotter and said, so tell me about this teletransportation project you were on. And I said, well, doctor, you've asked that kind of sarcastically as if I'm delusional. And I just want you to know, I'm not delusional. I am experiencing some stress because naturally and understandably, to the extent that the secret government activities I was involved in by my father were hidden from my five other family members, my five other immediate family members and most everybody else as well.
Yeah.
It's hard for them to believe that I'm not just making up a strange story, but that's not what was happening. I was going back and writing down my story, just like my dad had asked me before he died in 1990, 10 years earlier, you see? So in answer to your question, that did happen. But then as I began to do radio and my siblings began to listen to the coherence and finally understand how the time travel activities and the Mars activities I was involved in were masked from then, they kind of got it. They thought, oh, now we get it. Andy's been telling the truth all along. The things he was involved in by dad were hidden from us. And that's why it seems so strange when he started talking about this stuff. So again, we have to become students of epistemology, the study of the theory of knowledge.
Yes.
Just because somebody hasn't told you something or not even remembered it doesn't mean it didn't happen to them. That's another fallacy. That if you didn't tell me back then or didn't remember back then, therefore what you're saying now is not true. I even had a friend who I've known since the seventh grade say that. And I said, I don't want to say his name, but I said, my friend, I in fact told about my teleportation activities to Mrs. Marks' seventh grade honors English class at Lawrence Junior High School, and you were sitting on the right side of the room, three desks back. And when I revealed that I'd been teleporting back and forth across the country in this 5-minute talk I had to give in that honors English class, you pulled your hair and tilted forward in your seat. Now, this was a friend of mine who's a professional writer who said, I've known you since the seventh grade, and you never talked about this stuff back then. In fact, I had said it right to his face and the face of the other 30 or so kids in my honors English class in the seventh grade at Lawrence Junior High School in Chatsworth, California. So one of the things we need to do is practice what I call objectified open-mindedness. You don't have to believe or not believe somebody. Just listen to what they're claiming and then try to find correlations. And the one I just offered about Carrie Cassidy and David Wilcock talking about Project Camelot, that directly corroborates my statement that Carl Jack Pruitt, Lieutenant, United States Navy, born 1934, father of the late Glenn Pruitt and two other children, was, when he was training us for the chronovisor, said, but if we stand out here outside the hologram, this will serve as a looking glass to the past or future. Okay, so these are correlations that have occurred throughout the truth movement, and there's been almost no attempt to engage in correlation.
Yeah, we'll have to do another interview to go into the Mars stuff because it's a whole other thing, and I really want to zone in on time travel. Specifically, I don't know if you'd be open to that.
I would.
Okay, to zone in, to keep it all about time travel, let's talk about the Philadelphia experiment. And Montauk, because those are the other ones that I think are, I mean, you know, we've talked a little bit before about Preston Nichols versus Albie Alec and sort of, you know, whether how much is science fiction, how much is real. And I was just actually reading through, I'm actually going to be interviewing, I wasn't able to last week, Peter Moon, who wrote the Montauk books with Preston Nichols. And I'm going to be asking him about a bunch of things related to it pretty soon. But I was reading the first of the books and... my gosh, they talk about Mars I didn't even realize that Mars was part of the equation. Duncan Cameron and imagining this, there's a pyramid on Mars and visualizing a space to be able to teleport between that and Mars. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, this is all really messy and kind of confusing. Andy's story is much, at least it's cleaner to understand. Look, what was going on in Montauk, in your opinion?
Well, let's start with Philadelphia Experiment.
And Philadelphia, too. I want to know about that.
Right, yeah. Right. There's been, I have the information to clarify everything you've asked in these four questions in one.
Yeah, okay. It's a lot of questions. Well, let's start with, but I'm very curious.
Yeah, Greg, let's start with a project with the Philadelphia Experiment.
Rainbow, right? Project Rainbow is how it was referred.
Right. I it may have been, I don't know, but I do know from numerous statements that Dr. Robert Beckwith made to me in childhood when I was on Project Pegasus, and two interviews I did with him when he was quite elderly, like around, around the year 2006 and 7, and he would die in 2009. He was also interviewed by Alexander Bruce and Ken Thomas. And I write this up in my paper, The Real Philadelphia Experiment and the Philadelphia Experiment Cover Story. Something like the Philadelphia Experiment happened, but everything was changed. First of all, it wasn't radar invisibility of the Eldridge. It was Tesla teleportation of a ship called the Martha's Vineyard. John von Neumann, Nikola Tesla, nor Albert Einstein were at the command of the ship, but J. Robert Oppenheimer and Edward Teller. It didn't go back to Norfolk, Virginia, when they powered down. It went back to Newport News, Virginia. There weren't multiple sailors captured in the hull of the ship. There was one sailor who was impaled on a column that supported the splash cowling of the ship.
Huh.
And it didn't take place even in Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. It took place in Long Island Sound. But it did take place either toward the end of Tesla's life or after his death, and it was into Tesla teleportation. But they realized that they couldn't Tesla teleport a huge hunk of metal, namely a ship. And there was huge electrostatic discharge that was seen on the shore and by the other sailors and so forth. But there's only one tragic death of one of the sailors. Now, after the war, they invented the Philadelphia Experiment cover story that's come down through us through that Carl Allen, Carlos Allende story. I think M.K. Jessup played a role in disseminating that. And that was to de-link three things they didn't want known: the connections between Tesla, teleportation, and the Los Alamos physicists. Okay.
Yeah.
So when Al Bielek saw the Philadelphia Experiment, the movie, he imagined that he had jumped off the Eldridge and become one of the Cameron brothers, thereby confusing teleportation and reincarnation. I interviewed Al Bielek. Al Bielek was an interesting personality, a highly creative intellect, but I don't believe that he was speaking about veritable experiences. He certainly wasn't on Project Pegasus, and I was on it officially beginning in 1969. And Al Bielek even remembered his experiences time traveling for the country 15 years later. He's also told the story of another recovery of his memory, not watching the Philadelphia Experiment movie, but going to a yard sale or something, some flea market or something, where there was memorabilia from the Philadelphia Experiment. Okay, so now let's hold Al right there for now and talk about Preston Nichols and Peter Moon. Preston Nichols and Peter Moon wrote their series of books about Montauk and essentially started the Montauk subculture with information that was provided by who? By Jack Prewitt and his son Glenn. What was the thrust of that information, or disinformation, if you will? It was to depict the Montauk chair which, by the way, was just called the Chair when we were using it in Project Pegasus 15 years before Project Montauk was launched in 1983. Mm-hmm. I was first put in the Montauk chair like in 1970, okay? But it was just called the Chair.
Right.
What it did was send you to a moment in your own subjective future. So if you were destined to go to Mars via aeronautical repositioning chamber under Howard Hughes, like I was, then yes, you would remember that. But there was no way to independently send you via Montauk chair to the moon because it was not a teleporter. It just sent you to moments in your own subjective future as lived. Now, did all of the things I was sent to happen? No. Because what they discovered when I was on the project is that every moment in your life and everything you do is a tripartite experience. Like, I can continue to sit here in my chair and be interviewed by you, I can stand up and be interviewed by you, or I can put the phone down and hang up and leave this interview, right?
Right.
I could have gone to UCLA in 1980, stayed at UC San Diego, or dropped out of school, right? You can take the first girl you want to take to the prom, the first alternate, or another alternate, or not go to the prom, right? Everything right. In life is a tripartite outcome. So what we're actually seeing was, yes, some subjective moments in our own futures, but also things in our future that didn't happen because in that tripartite selection of outcomes, we just didn't lead to that destiny. You follow?
Yes. Yes.
The chair, in other words, was mapping future events that would happen and future events that could have happened but didn't because of tripartite decision-making in the complexity of the ebb and flow of time, time-space itself. Okay? So you can literally be working at a company and one day make a left turn in a certain hallway and meet your wife. Or if you make a right turn in that hallway, not meet your wife. And then maybe yes. She can be moved to another department and you never meet her. That's how life is. In other words, it's always a tripartite outcome. I recently asked my professor at Cambridge to see if he could see that I'm granted a PhD honoris causa. He either could have answered my letter and said, yes, Andy, I will work on this for you, or answer me with a nice hello and a nice turn down, or not answer my letter. And that's what happened. Okay. Huh. So right. That means we can't be afraid to try things because there always is going to be a tripartite outcome, whatever it is. It's like you try to get into the Olympics, you win Olympic gold, or you get into the Olympics and don't win Olympic gold. The Michelle Kwan experience. Okay. So that's what the Montauk chair was doing. It was showing us things that would happen and things that could have happened, but somewhere along the way, one of the other two possibilities is what emerged. Now, when they were given the information by Carl Pruitt and Jack Pruitt, I think that Preston Nichols and Peter Moon did a very important job, just like Al Bielik did with his work, which is, they shared ideas about time travel. They sort of sensitized the public to the discourse. And just like science fiction, which their works were not, they were science fact, but they were incomplete science fact. They were, you know, and then when Al Bielik tried to synthesize the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk experiment with Project Mars, he was really just trying to agglomerate all of the non-ordinary quantum access type activities that the government had been involved in, which I've now tried to clarify. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, it's just a lot of stuff to sort through, like figuring out, you know, who is, how they even, I mean, look, I've talked to several people now in my search to speak with people who might be time travelers that are like, yeah, I've been in a Montauk chair before, and I'm going, well, wait a minute, that's different than what Andy said a Montauk chair was. So what were you in if you were, maybe they just called it that. I mean, okay, let's go with this question. Do you think if somebody says like, yeah, I was in a Montauk chair when I was young, were they in some time travel device? Is there any possibility that that could have been a thing?
Yeah, I was in it and I was visiting subjective moments in my own future. I gave them one time the name, the ethnicity, and the physical appearance of one of my future sister-in-laws, yeah, I was seeing people from the future and giving their names. And that's one of the reasons why Project Montauk was launched after, quote unquote, the chair had been used in Project Pegasus. For one reason, your body stayed back in the chair, but
yeah,
could not be injured. And the second reason, I think they turned it into a fully fledged sub-project of Pegasus and launched Project Montauk, was it was extremely effective at getting very reliable information about the future. Like I remember these interviews. One time, I was in the Montauk chair with Ed Dames in New Mexico. It was in a secret lab beneath the auxiliary basketball court at the Los Alamos Public High School. And he asked me what I was watching. And what I was seeing was, in 2004, I saw an appearance by Senator John Kerry in Portland, Oregon. He appeared with Howard Dean of Vermont. And he was running for president. And I said to Ed Dames that I was looking at a race for president by John F. Kerry.
Huh.
And he turned to me and he turned to me and said, "Did you say John F. Kennedy?" And I said, "No, John F. Kerry." So in other words, in sending us to moments in our subjective future, they were able to see emergent facts that hadn't emerged yet. And that's what they were taking down. They were using the Montauk chair to get information about what the future held. In a Montauk chair reading that I did as a freshman at UC San Diego in 1979-80, I gave them the names of the president and the vice president in the future. And they said, "What are their names?" And I said, "Bill Clinton and Al Gore." And they said, "When, Andy, when are they going to be president and vice president?" And I said, "During the two terms before the turn of the century." And I was right. Right? 1993 to 2001, Clinton Gore. Okay, so after being elected in 92. So
yeah,
that's how they were using the Montauk chair. They would send you forward in time, and even if you got one of those other timelines that you weren't destined to walk on, sometimes you still came up with the right information. Like if my friend Eva had said to me, "Andy, let's go down and see, John Kerry's appearing down in downtown Portland. Let's go down there and see him because we're not probably be able to ever see somebody running for president again." If I had said, "No, Eva, I don't think I want to go down there and see John Kerry. I'm not a big fan of his. I might vote for him because I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I don't really need to see him," right? If I had said that, if I had accessed that in the Montauk chair, I still would have said, "A friend of mine in Portland is asking me to go downtown Portland to see John Kerry's talking when he's running for president." And that would have given them the knowledge that John F. Kerry of Massachusetts would one day run for president, even
yeah,
if I didn't see his speech, you see? So that's how it was being used, even when I was a kid on the project, both in New Jersey and New Mexico, and then as a freshman at UC San Diego in 1979-80. So
wow,
yes, the Montauk chair was a rudimentary form of time travel. It was sort of quasi-physical because your body did go there, but at the same time, your physical body stayed back in the chair, in the laboratory.
Yeah. Wait a minute. So you were in California late 70s. Was this related when you went into the chair at that point? What was the reason? Was there a chair in California or was it related to the Mars?
The chairs could be put wherever they were set up. That was a special continuation of Project Pegasus that I was brought into when I was a freshman at UC San Diego. Every Tuesday at about 5 o'clock in the morning, I would get up at Muir College, Tenaya Hall, third floor, and I would walk over to Fourth College, which later became Warren College.
Yeah.
And I would be placed in the Montauk chair. And by then they were externalizing the images in our brain in a screen in front of us. So they were attaching electrodes to our skulls, and we were watching what we were seeing of the future. And they said, "Who are those guys?" And I said, "Oh, that's easy. That's Bill Clinton and Al Gore." And they said, "Who are they?" And I said, "The president and vice president." And they said, "When, Andy?" And I said, "In the two terms before the turn of the century." So I was literally looking at a picture of Clinton and Gore from my brain being projected on a screen in front of me from electrodes that were attached to my brain while I sat in the Montauk chair.
Yeah. And if you said earlier that they had multiple, or you said the chair was recovered from an ET craft, if they had multiple chairs, did they deconstruct the one that they originally found that just built more?
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't told everything about the provenance and derivation of the devices. I was just told in the learning program on Galileo, the speed learning program, that the chair that we were going to be placed in had been recovered from an extraterrestrial craft.
Right.
And it had been the pilot seat of the craft that he used to literally command the vehicle as it was flying at supersonic speed, you know, super luminal speeds through space.
Yeah. Yeah, because in the Peter Moon book, they're talking about discovering and wrapping different, I mean, I don't even know. I've heard Tesla coil thrown around a lot with this time travel stuff. Wrapping coils around the chair and discovering its properties. You could, sort of what you described, except with Duncan Cameron especially, who was a psychic projecting images in his mind and then it would manifest in front of him and stuff like that. I mean, look,
Greg, in this era, let me mention something very important. And that is, because I knew that Project Montauk had happened,
yeah,
because I knew the chair existed and I had worked with Jack Pruitt as a team leader on Project Pegasus, and Nichols and Moon had identified him as the research director of Project Montauk.
Mm.
What I decided to do regarding Nichols and Moon and Al Bielek and other people attempting to tell the best possible story they could, but telling a partial or incomplete or partially inaccurate story,
yeah,
often based on who their source was, I decided to affirm that aspects of Al Bielek's story was true because he made the connection between Tesla, Los Alamos, the Tesla teleportation and the Los Alamos physicist, those three things, and that Nichols and Moon were talking about real activities by the U.S. government because the chair existed and Jack Pruitt was a real guy that I had met when I was a kid, and I had met as recently as 2003 at the Sweeney Auditorium in Santa Fe, formerly in Santa Fe. They tore it down. So anyway, what I wanted to mention was, because I took that approach of not criticizing, but valorizing the contribution they made, in other words, giving credit where credit was due, when I was then interviewed by Jesse Ventura on conspiracy theory, they all came forward, as did Stuart Swerdlow, just as David Wilcock did when I appeared on Project Mars on Shadow Operations with Project Camelot. They came forward and said, you've got to talk to this guy, Andy. Why? Because I had correlated everything I did in Pegasus, and I had established that, in fact, Project Montauk was a later sub-project of Project Pegasus, and I gave the reasons why. You see, so this is part of epistemology. If we spend the rest of this century blaming people for things they never did, you know, like I remember when I was a kid, these kids at my grandma's house in Summit Hill, Pennsylvania, said the old lady down the street had cut kids' hair off of it and made spaghetti with it.
Right.
That's kind of what's going on in our whole culture now. People are making up completely crazy stories and blaming entirely innocent people for those alleged acts. Okay?
Yeah.
So if we keep on doing that, rather than correlating what others are bringing forward, we're never going to get to the truth. Okay, and I just wanted to mention this because that worked. In other words, when I affirmed that Nichols and Moon had shared a lot of truth about the Montauk chair, that Jack Pruitt had served in Pegasus before it, that Al Bielek had made the critical connection between Tesla teleportation and the Los Alamos physicists based at the Los Alamos National Labs in Sandia, they really appreciated that because I wasn't attacking them, just presenting my story. Don't attack others. Just tell your story and then distinguish what alleged truth tellers have said with what they themselves have said. Bear in mind, I didn't knock down the claims of Randy Kramer based on my experiences of Mars. I knocked down Randy Kramer's account of going to Mars based on his discrepant accounts.
Mm.
His claims that his wife was alternatively named Deirdre. He told Dr. Sala that his wife on Mars was named Deirdre, but then 4 years later, he couldn't tell me the name of a single comrade on Mars. And then he told me just this year that the name of his wife on Mars was Doris. Okay, so I've knocked down some alleged truth tellers, based on discrepancies in their accounts, but not in the difference of my account with their account. And again, that's one of the reasons why I'm holding a candle that someday we will learn exactly what has happened to Randy Kramer, or to, excuse me, to Corey Good, because I can't see where Corey would adopt the platform he's adopted were he not an experiencer. That's my profound belief.
Yeah.
But I don't know, because I didn't walk in his moccasins, right? None of us can really ultimately evaluate somebody else's experiences by comparing their alleged experiences to our experiences. We can only compare their claims to their claims.
Yeah.
And then try to determine whether they've been telling the truth or not, or just making up a work of science fiction. So anyway, I did that with the Montauk experiencers and with Al Bielek, and it worked. Al was, I think, deceased the year 2011, the year that was filmed, but Stuart Swerdlow and Preston Nichols and Peter Moon pretty much gave me a good word, and that allowed Jesse to get to the truth that I was telling the truth and that the time travel program had existed. But then at the end of the show, again, in violation of the same principles of epistemology, the study of the theory of knowledge, Jesse Ventura was either told to or felt personally compelled to make up the false claim that I had been a victim of government mind control and I had never time traveled because it didn't exist. Well, how can you prove a negative? You can't.
Yeah.
You know who took that approach because he wanted to discover time travel was Ronald Mallett on time travel. And because he wants to be the first person to put people on Mars, Elon Musk. Both of them have never questioned me at length. And I've done, you know, hundreds of interviews. And I've been telling the truth. So if you block somebody else's truth because you don't believe what they're talking about is possible, you basically prevent yourself of learning about evolving truth.
Have you reached out to those guys? You've reached out to Elon and Ron Mallett?
Yes, I've done it in dozens of interviews and conference proceedings. I did appear on... I appeared on the Huffington Post Live with Ronald Mallett, and he was sitting there snarking. Literally, he was on camera snarking at me with this snarky, derisive expression like, oh, I'm so sick of this guy. He's just making this stuff up, and I still want to discover time travel and go back and visit my dad. You know. And I've actually said to Ronald Mallett, I said, Ron, I know you want to discover time travel to go back and visit your late father, I'm sorry, it already was developed by DARPA. I'm blowing the whistle. I was in it. And so that's another dilemma or another shortcoming of epistemology in our culture. And that is, I call it me first-ism. Mm. If you won't believe somebody else's experience because you want to achieve it or experience it first, you will never either experience it first or learn the truth because they experienced it before you. And believe me, my whole life, I've heard about things I haven't done yet from others, except time travel. I mean, think, just in your personal life, where somebody told you about something, like some ride at an amusement park or something, right?
Yeah.
Or some paranormal experience, like seeing a ghost or something. Our whole lives are about hearing about something and then frequently hearing about it first and then experiencing it or doing it or achieving it. And for me to have to deal with grown-ups who won't believe me because they want to achieve first what I already did through the good graces of people like Harold Agnew and my father, Raymond, and Jack Pruitt of Parsons, and Sterling Colgate of New Mexico Tech, and Edward Teller, and the other guys working on Project Pegasus, is really shameful. I shouldn't have to not be believed by some people just because they're being denied the opportunity to achieve it first. That's not American. You know, George Washington will always be our first president under the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
But it was what? John Hanson, who was actually the first president, right? But we will always remember Washington as the first president under the Constitution. None of us can ever be the first president of the United States. So I just want everybody to grow up and stop getting on my case for telling them the truth.
Yeah.
Ronald Mallett will never discover time travel because it's already been discovered. And Elon Musk will never be the first individual to send people to Mars because we've been going there since 1964.
What about Marshall Barnes?
Well, Marshall is a great expert on the Philadelphia Experiment cover story, and this is part of the unenviable position I've been put in. I would never attack somebody like Marshall Barnes because he's a very bright, diligent individual who has learned everything he can about the quote-unquote Philadelphia Experiment rather than the Long Island Sound Experiment by which they were scripting the Philadelphia Experiment cover story. Okay? In the same way that, let's say, Janet and Sasha Lessen became experts on the claims of Zachariah Sitchin, which were science fiction.
Yes.
Okay, so that's part of the dilemma that we're living in, is that the truth movement, or exopolitics, ufology, is also peopled by very intelligent, very diligent researchers, like those three that I just mentioned, Marshall Barnes and the Lessons, who become experts on a cover story that's being advanced to hide the truth. And so people get taken advantage of, and then they get invested in those explanations. And it has to end.
Yeah.
And we're only going to end it through brotherhood and sisterhood, where we come together and we say, okay, this is not about any one person. It's about all of us and what our common culture has done. Let's figure it out. Sure, everybody has a story, but some of those stories are made up. So we have to identify which ones have been made up.
Yeah.
And move on. Like the guy, remember that guy who admitted that he'd made up the Apex time travel body of work?
Oh, who is
he? Did all those Apex shows? He did. I don't remember his name. He did all those Apex travel stories.
I don't remember.
I didn't.
There's the John Titor thing. I've never talked to you about John Titor. Do you know that whole saga? The guy from 2036?
I had to answer questions when I went forward as an actual experiencer of time travel. I had to answer questions. I was asked to my face by George Norrie when I first appeared on Coast. On November 11th of 2009, I have to ask you, are you John Titor?
Yeah.
And I said, I wish I had said, but I said, no, I am not. I'm Andy Bashago from Morris Plains, New Jersey, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Hello, America. You know, I'm your native son, you know? I shouldn't have to be asked whether I'm John Titor any more than Abraham Lincoln had to ask whether he was George Washington. You know what I mean? We cannot let legends about the past color our understanding of the present. But no, John Titor's story was made up, and his lawyer brother admitted it. And then with the Apex stories, that guy who scripted all of those came forward and admitted all of his stories were made up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my response to those saying that everybody has a story, I go, well, there's your example. Sure. Experiencers have stories, and people who make stuff up have stories. So it's not really a matter of everybody having a story. It's a matter of finding which stories are experiences and which are fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
have you looked at that
true
patent? I mean, have you looked at the John Titor patent and all that technology about two magnetic housing units I'm looking at it right now for dual microsingularities and an electron injection manifold? Like, there's like a whole patent for this device.
Yes, I looked at it, and it was not the Tesla teleporter that I was using to travel in Vortal tunnels through time-space beginning in 1968.
Yeah,
I knew it wasn't the device. I knew it wasn't it wasn't any device I had had contact with, and it made no sense because you can't physically move through a medium like that without being cellularly destroyed. That's why the kind of teleportation on Star Trek could not be the form that emerged. It's not the form that emerged. You would have been killed by that.
Yeah.
You had to go through a tunnel in time-space, not be disintegrated and reintegrated at the destination.
Right,
Be disintegrated at the point of embarkation, I've been saying, and then reintegrated at the destination. That's just not physically possible.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I'm always curious about you and the future, because that's another thing you've talked about, and it certainly was when you were running for president. You went to the future. I mean, what device was that? When was that future trip? Is there anything you can tell us about what it's going to look like? Don't you want to know what's going to happen in the future? There's a reason this podcast is called Open Loops. Because you're going to have to listen to the next episode to find out.
Final episode of Andrew DeBasciago coming out tomorrow on Podcast Pegasus. Where we're going, we don't need roads. But that's mostly because we have an infrastructure problem in America. And no one's driving anyway. And if they did, they don't want to go on those roads. They're terribly broken. We'll talk to you tomorrow. I'm Greg Bornstein. Take care.